Thank you, Rabbi Shore. This evening, Birshutchem, I'd like to take you on a journey together with me. A journey to Warsaw, the Warsaw of then and now, the Warsaw of yesterday and today, and share with you some pictures, video, music, stories, and reflections from my visits to Poland on this Yom HaShoah. Here in Israel, Yom HaShoah has a dual identity. It's Yom HaZikaron LaShoah VeLaGvura. It's a mouthful, but that's the official title of the day. Yom HaZikaron LaShoah VeLaGvura. It's Yom HaZikaron LaShoah, a day to remember the Holocaust, to commemorate, to memorialize, to reflect, to consider the Kedoshim, all that we've lost. But part of that very identity is Gvura. We also recognize and reflect on the heroism, the resistance, and the resilience. And the Gvura, the strength. In fact, initially, it was proposed that Yom HaShoah be observed on the day the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising began. Now, some of you may know, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising began on Erev Pesach, so you can imagine some of the reactions. But following much debate, on September 1st, 1951, the Knesset passed a formal resolution establishing the 27th of Nisan, tonight, as Yom HaShoah Umered HaGhetto. That was the original title of the day, identifying the day with, again, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. A number of years later, on April 8th, 1959, the Knesset passed a law officially establishing Yom HaZikaron LaShoah VeLaGvura, Holocaust and Heroism Remembrance Day, as an annual commemoration of the disaster which the Nazis and their collaborators brought upon the Jewish people and the acts of heroism and revolt and resistance performed. So they settled on the 27th of Nisan, which is enough time to put away your Pesach dishes, but also close enough to the uprising and positioned just a week before Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzma'ut, our Yamim HaNoraim here in Medinat Yisrael, if you will. Again, reinforcing the theme of Gvura, of strength, heroism, resistance, and resilience. Me'avdut l'cheirut, mi'agon l'simcha, u'me'eva l'yom tov, mi'shibud l'geula. Here we've suffered so much, and then we went on to build a state, like the dry bones in Yechezkel's vision. And so tonight, we will look together at both the tragedy and the triumph of the human spirit. Now, unfortunately, we're all too familiar with the painful images of life in the ghetto, the humiliation, the degradation, the disease, the hunger, the pain. One of the most striking things about visiting Warsaw today is just how little of the ghetto is left. Everything is gone. Following the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, the Nazis went house to house, building by building, setting fires, blowing things up. Whatever wasn't destroyed while the ghetto was liquidated was destroyed later when the Nazis would raise the city in late 1944 after the Polish resistance uprising. Not to mention the aerial assault and bombings of Warsaw by the German Luftwaffe during the siege of Warsaw and the invasion of Poland in 1939. So there's not much left today of the ghetto. But here, these are some of the remaining walls and buildings of what is left of the Warsaw ghetto. You can see the characteristic red brick of the buildings and walls that were part of the Warsaw ghetto. Okay, let's see, this should work. So yeah, I took some video just to give you something. Unfortunately, what remains today is in the process of being torn down. Much of what's left is in the process of being torn down. Here, another wall that's left. More walls of the ghetto and that characteristic red brick. Closely, you can even see damage to the wall from bullets and mortar shells, all that took place during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. So these are some of the remaining walls and buildings that are left today of what was the Warsaw Ghetto. Now, the Warsaw Ghetto was created in November of 1940, and it was the largest ghetto in Nazi-occupied Europe, with over 400,000 Jews confined to an area of just 1.3 square miles. I'm talking about a tiny, tiny area in Warsaw. Hunger and disease were rampant, living conditions unbearable, with an average of 9.2 persons per room. And families would have to find places to live. You know, they'd be put in the ghetto and they would have to share a home with other families. In July of 1942, the gross action mass deportations to Treblinka began. And by then, approximately 100,000 Jews had already died of starvation and disease. And as I mentioned, on Erev Pesach, April 19th, 1943, German soldiers arrived to liquidate the ghetto within 3 days, but instead they were ambushed by Jewish insurgents firing guns and tossing Molotov cocktails and hand grenades from alleyways, sewers, and windows. Street battles took place in the weeks that followed. Homes were burned. As I mentioned, the Germans, Yimach Shemam, used gas and explosives to flush out members of the resistance and flush them out of their underground bunkers and buildings. And on May 8th, 1943, the command bunker of the resistance was located, bringing the uprising to an end. And I'll show you a picture shortly of where that bunker was. But during the uprising, approximately 13,000 Jews were killed, many of them burned. Many died from smoke inhalation. Those that were left alive were deported to Treblinka or other camps. And following the uprising, as I mentioned, the ghetto was just completely destroyed. Now, the ghetto was divided into two, along Klodna Street, which was not included in the ghetto. Klodna was a very important thoroughfare which linked the east and the west of the city, and it was too important to include in the ghetto. So what did they do instead? They built two ghettos, a small ghetto and a large ghetto. The area south of Klodna was known as the small ghetto, while the area north of Klodna Street was the large ghetto. And these two zones were connected with an intersection, and there was a special gate that was built so the Jews living in the ghetto could travel between the small and large ghetto. This here, in this slide, this line here in the middle, right on the pavement, commemorates where the dividing line stood that separated between the small and large ghettos. And on both sides of the street, and I'll show you in a moment, you can see remnants of a footbridge that was ultimately built to connect the two ghettos. And this here, this is a picture from the 1940s, from the ghetto, when Jews were going from one part of the ghetto to the other, from the small ghetto to the large ghetto. This is what the footbridge looked like. It went over this street. And today you can still see some remnants here. If you look to the left of the picture, you see these two tall posts. They almost look like utility towers, but those are actually remnants of what was the footbridge. Here is a video where I'll show you the street and both sides of what's left of that. So this is a very important street, a thoroughfare. It also was home to many affluent people and shops as well. So obviously they did not want to include it inside of the ghetto. Okay, on this next slide, you'll see the Umschlagplatz monument, which stands on what was the Umschlagplatz, this loading yard, where from 1942 to 1943, the Germans transported over 300,000 Jews from the Warsaw Ghetto to death camps. During the gross action, Jews were terrorized in daily roundups, marched through the ghetto, and assembled here at the Umschlagplatz for what the Nazis called resettlement to the east. From there, they were sent aboard overcrowded cattle cars to extermination camps like Treblinka.
The largest number of Jews were transported from this very spot to their deaths in the period between Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur of 1942. And so this monument here stands to commemorate and to recall and to memorialize this space. And it was built to resemble an open freight car. You'll see, I'll show you a video in a moment, you can see that it's supposed to look like a freight car, a very large freight carter. And the white stone with this stripe in the middle is supposed to evoke the talus. I don't see it, but that's what the artists said, that they wanted this image of the talus with the white and the black stripe. And the stone on top is supposed to look like a gravestone, like a matseva. You also have names all across this monument, 400 most popular Jewish-Polish first names in alphabetical order, from Abba to Zana, are engraved on the monument. And each name is supposed to commemorate 1,000 victims of the Warsaw Ghetto. There's an inscription that reads, along this path of suffering and death, over 300,000 Jews were driven in 1942 to 1943 from the Warsaw Ghetto to the gas chambers of the Nazi extermination camps. So this is a larger view of what the inscription. Now, for 1,000 years, Judaism flourished in Poland. In fact, it was called by the Jews Polin. Here we have found rest. Come, stay, come, live. But as I mentioned today, there's not much left of Jewish Warsaw or of the ghetto, mostly monuments to a world that once was. One testament to what was Jewish life in Poland, which still stands, is the Nozick Synagogue. This is the beautiful Nozick Synagogue. Before World War II, Warsaw was one of the largest Jewish communities in the world. It had over 400 Batei Knesset, over 400 shuls, and that's not even counting all the different shtiblach. I visited some shtiblach that remain in Praga, other parts to the east of Warsaw, where tradesmen, people involved in different businesses would get together to daven mincha. But there were over 400 synagogues in Warsaw, and the Nozick Synagogue is the only pre-war synagogue that survived. It was built between 1898 and 1902 in the Romanesque revival style. The synagogue was designed by a famous Warsaw architect, Karol Kozlowski, who also designed the Warsaw Philharmonic Orchestra Hall. Unfortunately, during the war, the Germans used this building as horse stables and as a depot, which unfortunately was not uncommon. But after the war, the shul was restored and reopened in 1983. It currently houses Jewish communal organizations and daily minyanim. I had the privilege of davening here a number of times, and you can imagine how meaningful it is to daven in this beautiful shul, the only shul that survived the war. Here's the end of the davening. Catch a weekday concert. How meaningful it is to daven here with the minyan and answer, you hate Shnei Rav Mevarach. This is Warsaw's Okopo Street Cemetery. As a Kohen, I couldn't really go in, but I took these pictures from the entrance to the cemetery, which is one of the largest Jewish cemeteries in the world. It was established in 1806, and the cemetery contains over 250,000 marked graves, as well as, unfortunately, mass graves of victims of the Warsaw Ghetto. After the war, Kivrei Achim, you know, they brought bodies here from all over to be buried. You can even see at the bottom of your screen here, incorporated into the wall here of the cemetery are fragments from tombstones. Here's some more pictures of broken tombstones that were brought from different parts of Warsaw, as well as other communities, other places in Poland were brought, the fragments of their tombstones were brought here to be preserved. It remains an active cemetery until today, serving Warsaw's existing Jewish community. But we'll... Okay, now here's a sign when you enter of all the great tzaddikim, all the great rabbonim that are buried here. Among the many gedolim that are buried here are Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, Rav Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Nitziv, Rav Elazhin, and many Hasidic rebbes. Let's take a look at the list here. All these admorim, Zchutam Yagen Aleinu. And there's a sculpture in the back of the cemetery, a very famous sculpture, which depicts the famous scene of Janusz Korczak marching with his orphans. Of course, can't speak about Warsaw or the Warsaw Ghetto without mentioning Janusz Korczak. Janusz Korczak was a Warsaw-born educator, author, pedagogue, who served as director of the orphans' home on Krachmalna Street from 1912 through the occupation. Here is a picture of his famous orphanage. I took it through the gate. Can't get too close, but this is a picture of where the orphanage was. And Korczak was ahead of his time, you know, in his writings and on the radio show that he hosted. One of the major recurring themes was the rights of children, that children are not to be just, you know, seen and not heard, but they have rights. They are little adults. And his life's work was protecting children. When the Germans created the Warsaw Ghetto in 1940, the orphanage was forced to move into the ghetto. This is the original building, not the building that was inside of the ghetto. But Korczak tried to make life in the ghetto as normal as possible for the orphans in his care. Time after time, even towards the very end, Korczak was offered sanctuary, and each time he refused, he would not leave his children behind. During the liquidation of the ghetto, eyewitnesses describe how Korczak marched with his children proudly, dressed in their finest Shabbos clothing, holding hands to the Umschlagplatz to be deported to Treblinka. And when they finally reached the Umschlagplatz, there's a story that an SS officer recognized Korczak as the author of one of his favorite children's books and offered to help him escape. In another version, the officer offers him some sort of special treatment. As we know, there were some prominent Jews with international reputations who were sent to Theresienstadt, for example. But according to the story, Korczak once again refused. Instead, he boarded the trains together with his children and was never heard from again. Witnesses describe how Korczak bravely led his children, clutching him tightly, into the gas chamber, as is depicted by this famous memorial right here. Speaking of heroism, this is me. I'm not the hero here, though. This is a picture outside of the Warsaw Zoo, where zoo director Jan Zabinski and his wife Antonina hid hundreds of Jews during the war, which is famously described in the award-winning book and later the film, The Zookeeper's Wife, for those of you who are familiar with the book and the film. During the German air assault on Warsaw in September of 1939, many of the animal enclosures were emptied and the animals were taken elsewhere. So the Zabinskis decided to utilize the pens and cages and empty stalls to hide Jews. They even hid Jews in their own private two-story home on the zoo's grounds. They were the zookeepers, so they had a home there. And were responsible, as I said, of saving the lives of hundreds of Jews. In 1968, they were recognized by the State of Israel as Hasidei Umot HaOlam for their heroic rescue of Jews during the Holocaust. This here is the Poland Museum. Not Poland Museum, but Polin, what the Jews for centuries called Poland. It was opened in 2013, and it covers 1,000 years of Jewish history in Poland, not just the Holocaust. It's a fascinating museum. All these digital exhibits and exhibitions, a lot to learn there. Spend a lot of time there. The building is a postmodern structure in glass, copper, and concrete, and was designed by Finnish architects, and it's supposed to evoke the biblical scene of Kriyat Yamsuf, the splitting of the sea, which we read not too long ago, we read about on Shvi Shel Pesach. I don't know. I don't see it, but it's supposed to look like Kriyat Yam Suf. That's what I was told. What's more interesting to me is the mezuzah case at the entrance to the museum. It's made from that iconic red brick of the Warsaw Ghetto, which I showed you earlier. Now, the museum is situated on the plaza where the Warsaw Ghetto Heroes Memorial stands. It's actually Heroes Memorials, as I'll show you in a moment. There are a number of memorials there, okay? All in this one area that's known as sort of Heroes Row, where a lot of the important memorials and monuments are, a lot of the iconic locations with regards to the Warsaw Ghetto. It's interesting. Poland, and we'll revisit this a little later on this evening, Poland has had a hard time with memory and with its responsibility in the Holocaust, and even, you know, just discussing the Holocaust and memorializing it. And it took years before they really began to create memorials in Poland. So this is the first memorial that's part of the Warsaw Ghetto's Heroes Monument. And this first part was created in 1946. And the shape of it resembles, many of you probably have already guessed, a manhole. It's very strange. And it has this inscription that's also, you know, interesting. The inscription is written in Polish, Hebrew, and Yiddish, and reads the following: to those who fell in the unprecedented and heroic struggle for dignity and freedom for the Jewish people, for a free Poland, and for the liberation of mankind, signed Polish Jews, or Sridei Yehudei Polim, the remnant of Polish Jewry. So you could see already they're not interested in talking about the devastation or the destruction. They're not really interested in reflecting on the pain. They're focused on the heroism, on the struggle for dignity and freedom and liberty. In front of the plaque is another plaque, a round plaque, featuring a palm leaf and the Hebrew letter bet for Breshit in the beginning. I was not able to find out exactly what the meaning behind that is. But on that same site, you have a later monument, and this is the famous monument known as the Rappaport Monument, sculpted by Warsaw-born Jew Nathan Rappaport. And that was first unveiled in April of 1948. Now, the choice of the wall motif was supposed to evoke the ghetto walls as well as the Kotel, the Western Wall in Jerusalem. And what's fascinating is that these very stones, that were incorporated into the monument actually came from German supplies ordered in 1942 by Albert Speer, Minister of Armaments and War Production, for planned Nazi monuments. Imagine that. They took supplies that were meant for Nazi monuments and made a monument to the Warsaw Ghetto and the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. So this is the eastern side of the monument, and it shows the persecution of Jews. Already by 1948, the Jewish community is ready to confront their pain. And so the eastern side shows the persecution of Jews by the hands of their Nazi tormentors, and it's supposed to evoke the Arch of Titus in Rome. You'll see it's very similar to the Arch of Titus in Rome, which features images of Jews exiled from Jerusalem and features a parade where they're parading the Klei HaMikdash. Instead, here you have Jews holding, clutching Torah scrolls, wrapped in talitot, etc. But you can see the pain on their faces. The other side, though, is very different. There I am, and behind me there's a wreath. I was told that the Polish president had been there the day before. So the western side depicts a group sculpture of strong men and women and children. Just take a look at all their muscles, right? They're armed with guns and Molotov cocktails. And who is in the middle? Who is the central figure? None other than Mordechai Anilevich, leader of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. So this monument here, with both of its sides, depicts both the tragedy as well as the triumph. In fact, just a few steps from this monument is the underground bunker at Mila 18. This was where the underground headquarters of Mordechai Analevich's ZOB, the Jewish Combat Organization, was. And even before the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, the Jews would use underground bunkers to smuggle things in and out of the ghetto, to plan things, to do what they needed to do. And so they had a whole system of tunnels and bunkers, as I mentioned, during the liquidation. The Nazis went house by house, building by building, bunker by bunker, tried to smoke out all the resistance. But on May 8th, 1943, 3 weeks after the start of the uprising, this bunker, which was the headquarters of the resistance, of the Jewish Combat Organization, of Mordechai Analevich, this bunker was discovered by the Nazis. And the Nazis used tear gas and eventually explosives to force the occupants out. Analevich, along with many members of the resistance, committed mass suicide by ingesting poison rather than surrender. And so in 1946, this mound, it's known as the Analevich Mound, was created from the rubble of nearby buildings. It was created by the Jews who had remained, and they created this mound. It still contains human remains. They did not bury all the remains there. And so, as a Kohen, I couldn't get very close. You want to get halachic, maybe it is the status of a Beit HaPras, a Beit Pras rather. You don't know if what's there. There's a body buried, there are bones. But that is the Analevich Mound. So you see, again, many symbols of tragedy as well as triumph. This here is a very special building, another symbol of Jewish life and the triumph of the human spirit. This is a building that survived the war. This is Warsaw's Jewish Historical Institute, the JHI. And as you can see from the writing in Hebrew and in Polish on the front of the building, it was formerly the Judaic Library of the Institute for Judaic Studies. Okay, this was the Sifriya HaRoshit LeMadei HaYahadut. And it was next to the Great Synagogue on Tlomlaki Street. Tlomlaki Street, which is the Great Synagogue, is no longer standing. But here is an old picture. It's actually a postcard, an illustration of what it looked like. On the left, you see the Judaic Library of the Institute for Judaic Studies. And on the right here, you see the Great Synagogue of Warsaw, which was destroyed. Now, the Jewish Historical Institute is important as it houses the Ringelblum archive, some 6,000 documents collected by Emanuel Ringelblum and members of his clandestine operation known by the code name Oineg Shabbos. It's a picture of Ringelblum. Emanuel Ringelblum was a Polish historian, politician, and social worker. And during his time in the ghetto, Ringelblum, together with a group of historians, writers, social workers, and rabbis, collected diaries, testimonials, artwork, and documents chronicling life in the ghetto during Nazi occupation. Initially, the plan was to document the atrocities being committed by the Nazis. But with time, the operation Oneg Shabbos broadened its mission and vision, so to speak. And they wanted to preserve what life was like in the ghetto. And it's absolutely fascinating. Many of you are probably familiar with the book and film, Who Will Tell Our Story, right? So, one second. I think that's the name of the film, Who Will Tell Our Story. They were interested in preserving what their lives were like and what life was like in the ghetto day to day. So they had diaries and reports and articles and artwork and photographs and official records and
underground newspapers that the Jews published in the ghetto, and posters and flyers for events and tickets, invitations, food stamps, poetry, photographs, personal correspondence, all giving a vivid description of ordinary life in the ghetto during the war, because they wanted to tell their story. They asked the question, who will tell our story? They wanted to be able to tell their own story. And so this was a really great act of rebellion and of resistance. Now, how were they able to operate? So what's interesting is Ringelblum operated the Alleinhilfe self-help, which was a social welfare organization, a network of social workers and soup kitchens and schools. And so during the war, he was able to operate his self-help organization out of this building. And so this building was not destroyed by the Nazis, and Ringelblum was able to operate because the Nazis tolerated this Jewish self-help organization, which even got funding from abroad, even from the United States, before the United States joined the war. And so it was a perfect cover for the activities of the Oneg Shabbos. Now, why did they call themselves Oneg Shabbos? They would meet on Shabbos. This was their Oneg Shabbos. And so, you know, as I said, they were preserving all these documents. They also would end up preserving many Divrei Torah as well, if you're familiar with the story of the Esh Kodesh, which we'll talk about in a moment. But during the deportations from July 1942 until May 1943, when the ghetto was being liquidated, a small staff of devoted workers took the pains to hide all that material in secure places. And the collection was sealed inside of metal containers and milk cans and buried under the Warsaw Ghetto in August 1942 and in March and April 1943. Okay, so all these precious documents were buried. Now here is the picture of some of these metal containers and metal milk cans, which housed these containers. So in September of 1946, after the war, they discovered the first cache. Now, it's interesting, there were 60 members of, someone is requesting control of the screen. There were 60 members of this organization, Oneg Shabbos, that were involved in preserving all these documents and submitting these documents and collecting them, Zamlers, people writing and collecting and reporting. But there were only six who knew as to the exact location of where the cache was hid, where the boxes and where the milk cans were hid, where these documents were hid. And only three members of the total group survived the war, one of which, miraculously, was one who knew where the boxes were buried. And so in 1946, they dug up the first cache, and they found these tin boxes in the ruins of the ghetto. And then later in December of 1950, they found two additional milk cans. Now there's a third cache that's rumored to be buried underneath what today is the Chinese embassy. Very interesting. But a search in 2005 failed to locate the missing material. So, you know, according to some, there may have never been a third cache at all. We just don't know. But many like to think that maybe there still is a third cache out there. So here, some of the survivors, together with scholars and historians, are going over the materials that they found in 1950. So this is actually a picture that I took. This is one of the milk cans that's on display in the Jewish Historical Institute. And in those milk cans, among, as I said, you know, all sorts of documents and newspapers and posters and slices of life, in those milk cans, they unearthed hundreds of pages of Divrei Torah of the Pizetzner Rebbe, Rav Kolonimus Kalman Shapira, Pizetzna, Hashem Yikom Domo, who was the Rebbe of Pizetzna before the war, was at the helm of a very important yeshiva before the war, and served as the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto from 1940 to 1942.
And like much of his activities in the ghetto, always giving chizuk to people, the Rebbe's drashot contain tremendous chizuk and faith and courage. And finally, in 1960, a collection of 86 drashot were published in Israel by Baruch Duvdevani under the title Eish Kodesh. Initially, they were referred to as the drashot Mishnot Hazam. The drashot, the homilies, the speeches, the sermons from the years of wrath, the years of fury. Okay. So here I am with one of the milk cans. This is a picture of the Pizetzna Rebbe, of Kolonimus Kalman Shapir of Pizetzna. We had about over a year ago already, a special Yahrzeit event at the OU Center to commemorate the Yahrzeit of the Pizetzna Rebbe. We shared about his life and discussed at length the tremendous miracle that really brought about the publication of Eish Kodesh. It was really a tremendous miracle, tremendous Hashkachat Hashem. So on display in the permanent exhibition at the Jewish Historical Institute is a manuscript that's written B'Ktav Yad Kodesho. This is it, written in his holy hand, among the other things they have there on exhibit. And it's a famous drasha that the Rebbe delivered on Chanukah 5702, along with a footnote at the bottom, you can see, that was added by the Rebbe almost 1 year later, on the 18th of Kislev, 5703, which relates to the terrible suffering by the hand of the Nazis. Already after the gross action and the deportations really began. And the manuscript is of particular significance. And this passage at the bottom, this footnote that the Rebbe later adds, is of particular significance as it was read by Baruch Duvdevani when he testified at the Eichmann trial on May 3rd, 1961. Okay, now this drasha and its footnote has also been the subject of much discussion and debate among scholars questioning if the Rebbe may have lost his faith somewhere along the way. Chas v'shalom, he didn't suggest that. But we spoke about that at length in our discussion of the Eish Kodesh and his life and the discovery of these drashot in our previous evening on his life at the OU Center. So the Rebbe, knowing that, the end was nearing with deportations continuing and increasing, he writes a cover letter to his brother here in Eretz Yisrael, who was known as the Admor HaChalutz, a pioneer, a Hasidic Zionist, and a Rebbe. And he asks anyone who finds the manuscripts to send them to his brother, the Admor HaChalutz, to publish, and gave the manuscripts to a member of Oneg Shabbos. There's much speculation as to who he gave it to. Some assume it was to Rabbi Shimon Huberband, who was a cousin of his and a member of Oneg Shabbos, and he himself contributed material to the collection, although others say that he may have already been deported at that time. So it's not so clear. Much speculation as to how the Divrei Torah of the Rebbe got there, but Baruch Hashem, they got there. Tremendous, tremendous miracles. Here I am wearing gloves in the library of the Jewish Historical Institute, and I was fortunate to be able to examine a manuscript of the Eish Kodesh of Rav Kolonimus Kalman Shapira. I was led to believe initially that it was written B'Ktav Yad Kodesho in his holy hand, although to my dismay, I later found out that it, in fact, while it is a Divrei Torah, it's a Dvar Torah that he wrote, that he gave over, this was actually not written by him, but written by a Talmud of his. This is actually a manuscript for a drasha for Pesach 1927, written before the war. It's not part of the Ringelblum archive, but it is housed at the Jewish Historical Institute, and it's part of their archives, their collection, and the drasha was published in the Sefer Derech HaMelech. Now, both the head archivist and the librarian could not tell me how the Institute acquired the manuscript or provide me any further information. As I said, I was led to believe that it was written by the Rebbe. Obviously, I was very excited, but then I found out that it was most likely written by a Talmud who would copy the Rebbe's manuscripts. The Rebbe would write his drashot, and his handwriting was very difficult to decipher. So each week, a student would come and copy the drasha. But then the Rebbe would review it and make notes and prepare it for publication. So perhaps it has some of the Rebbe's notes on it. Now, you know, Poland today struggles with their role in the Holocaust. I think out of all countries, you know, and I've been to many different countries in Europe, and I think Poland struggles most with its memory and its participation and collaboration with the Nazis. In fact, as I'm sure many of you know, in 2018, there was a law passed by Poland's nationalist and populist government, which penalizes anyone who has the chutzpah to admit complicity of the Poles in the crimes of the Holocaust. Yadenu lo shafchu et adam hazeh, ve'einenu lo ra'u. Their hands are clean. They refuse to acknowledge any culpability or take any responsibility. Their conscience is clean. They have a very short memory. And if you've been following the news, just last month, a Polish judge ordered two prominent historians, Jan Grabowski of the University of Ottawa and Barbara Engelking of the Polish Center for Holocaust Research, to issue a public apology. What was their offense? What was their crime? In 2018, they published a book called Night Without End, in which they quoted a Jewish survivor who describes how the wartime mayor and the killing of 18 Jews. So they were sued for libel by the mayor's 80-year-old niece. Imagine the chutzpah. And they were found guilty and ordered to make a public apology and publicly acknowledge. The Polish government is lashing out at any and all media outlets who have the chutzpah to suggest that the Poles were complicit. So one question which I'm often asked is, have I ever encountered anti-Semitism in Poland? I've been to many countries in Europe, I've been to Poland a number of times. Have I ever encountered anti-Semitism? Well, I want to show you some interesting slides, and you can decide for yourself. This picture here was taken in what is today a neighborhood of Warsaw, but it was its own settlement just outside of Warsaw, known as Praga. It's on the other side of the Vistula River, which runs through Warsaw and runs through much of Poland. It's on the east bank of the Vistula, which they call the Wisła. And while Warsaw was leveled, as we've mentioned, and completely destroyed, Praga was occupied already early on by the Russians. So Praga was left intact. And I had heard that besides for a number of interesting sites of Jewish interest and relevance, and history, Jewish history in Praga, I inquired about, you know, one of my great rabbinic heroes among many, Rav Menachem Zemba, was a very, very interesting rabbinic personality, very unique, always ran away from kavod, never wanted to take a formal rabbinic post, ultimately gets involved in Agudas Yisrael and in politics as a Jewish leader. But he was a big, big Talmud Chacham, wrote Svarim on the Bavli, Rishalmi, the Rambam, Rubo Kikulo. Most of the Torah that he authored was lost, unfortunately, during the Holocaust. You know, in addition to the tremendous loss of life, and I'm not obviously equating this with loss of life, but there's so much Torah scholarship that was also lost. So I've always been interested in this rabbinic personality of Menachem Zemba, and I was told that I can go to such and such a street and find the home where he lived. Now, it's very difficult as the names of the streets have changed, but I'm looking around and all of a sudden I see in a shop window, what looks to me over here in the middle right of the picture, looks to me like a Rebbe picture. I see this rabbi, distinguished looking rabbi with a long white beard, mitpayas. And I said, wow, maybe this is somehow connected to this building that I'm looking for. So I walk into the store, and then I see more and more of these pictures. Here's up close the picture through the window. Okay, so you see this nice Jew with a beard and payas. And I get into the store, and here, all along the wall, one after another, Rebbe pictures. And so I ask, Vas epis? What is this? What's going on here? What are all these Rebbe pictures? And someone explains to me
that these paintings are not Rebbe pictures, but rather these are a Jew with a coin, a very common picture that Poles, even till today, will purchase and hang in their homes. This old anti-Semitic stereotype, this trope of a wealthy Jew with a coin. Why do they hang it in their homes? It's somehow an omen or a good luck charm for wealth and prosperity. Okay. And in fact, all over Poland, I found more and more of these things. In tourist shops, in these coin Jews, these Jews with a coin, these money Jews. Sometimes they're holding a money bag. Sometimes they're holding a coin. I snapped this picture in a remote little resort village, a resort town in the south of Poland called Wisła, named for that river that runs through the country, where the Lauder Foundation runs a retreat each summer for members of Poland's Jewish community. And they invited me to come and teach and serve as a scholar in residence. And there, a little tourist shop, a little gift shop, you see these things which say, and I asked someone to translate what is written on the bottom. It says, Jew in the room, money in the pocket. Okay, Jew in the room, money in the pocket. And they're right underneath the Legos, the toys, and right next to the horseshoes. So you see, it's some sort of good luck charm. But obviously, you know, it's based on this old stereotype, this old trope of the rich Jew. Now, I've been told that sometimes they'll hang them in their home upside down. Sometimes they'll even shake them, hoping that coins will fall out, I suppose. The Poles that I've spoken with, including my friends and students there who are part of the Jewish community, you know, they laugh at this. They laugh this off as just an old superstition, an old Baba Misa, an old wives' tale, just a good luck charm that has stuck. Maybe. But it's still shocking when you see it, especially for the first time. And as I said, I found this all across Poland. And it reinforces these old and dangerous stereotypes. There's just too much history here, too much baggage. Here you see up close. It says, Jew in the home, money in the pocket. Some of them are made, you know, with big noses even. Okay, so the next few pictures I'll show you this evening were actually taken in Krakow, not in Warsaw. And these were taken in Nowy Plac, which is a plaza in the heart of Kazimierz. Kazimierz was the Jewish quarter in Krakow. Kazimierz was the heart of Jewish Krakow. That's where all the old shuls are, if you've ever been there. Krakow, unlike Warsaw, Krakow really survived the war intact, and the shuls there, the Jewish cemetery there, and the old shuls there, they survived the war, and they really, really are beautiful and worth seeing. So there in the heart of Jewish Krakow, in Kazimierz, which as I said, was the Jewish quarter, there's a flea market, and you have people selling all sorts of bric-a-brac and trinkets. And among the things that they're selling, you see, they're selling Torah pointers, Kiddush cups, old Israeli shekels, menorahs, all sorts of Judaica, even a Torah mantle, Torah covers. And alongside all of this Judaica, what do you find? Nazi war helmets and daggers and bayonets and medals and other Nazi paraphernalia. And of course, the ubiquitous Jew with a coin or a money bag, the money Jew, to hang in the home for prosperity. I took some pictures. Here I snuck some pictures, got yelled at. So here you see Nazi bayonets, Nazi daggers here. And at the bottom, you've got, you know, old shekels. Okay. You know, you can ask, well, are these Poles just opportunists trying to sell Judaica and Nazi paraphernalia to tourists? Maybe, but also it's painful to see and shocking to see, especially after all we've suffered, after all we've endured. There's too much history, too much baggage. Uh, Another question that I'm often asked about my visits to Poland and other places in Europe, including Germany, other countries whose earth is soaked, is drenched in Jewish blood. How can I go to such places? How can I travel to such places? Don't I feel guilty? Many people won't even step foot in Poland. Many Jews won't go back. Rav Lau, for instance, who participates in the annual March of the Living and speaks to the students who go on the March of the Living, he won't spend a night in Poland. It's a W.A.D.U. It's known that he won't sleep over in Poland. He'll go back to the airport and wait for the next plane back to Tel Aviv because the earth is soaked in Jewish blood. So this is a question that I've thought about a lot, especially when traveling on trains in Poland and having time to think, especially with all that trains in Poland conjure up. Besides for a 3-hour train delay from Krakow to Warsaw once, which almost cost me my flight back to Tel Aviv, I've crisscrossed the Polish countryside on its vast network of trains with pretty much no issue. In fact, I hate to admit it, but the cabins are comfortable and air-conditioned, the seats plush, there's ample legroom. You know, I'm usually there busy typing away on my laptop, working on a shiur, an article or something, and servers come and pass you by and offer you some pork-based breakfast. You know, I politely decline the pork-based breakfast, but I'll take a bottle of water. There's no Wi-Fi, but you know, I have my cell phone to tether to. And the only moment I felt the least bit of discomfort was when, after presenting my ticket once, I was asked to show my ID, to show my passport. While the tickets of all the other passengers, all the Poles around me, were scanned without question. Was it my kippah, my beard, my suit, my tzitzis? I don't know. But I do know that while I wasn't anxious per se, I do have much anxiety taking trains in Poland, as I think any Jew would. It's a deep anxiety rooted in baggage heavier than my 23-kilogram suitcase, which I slept on a train. It's an anxiety rooted in our collective history and recent memory. Riding a train in Poland evokes so many things for me as a Jew. And my mind begins to wander. We pass a village. And I ask myself, were there Jews in those homes? We pass a forest. And I ask myself, were Jews round up and shopping? You know, so pleasant and so polite, the voice that comes over the loudspeaker, when leaving the train, please remember to take all your belongings and luggage with you. As you pass by this beautiful countryside, but I ask myself, were Jews round up there and shot, buried there? Pass by a river. I ask myself, were Jews drowned there? Pass by a field. Were there Jews buried here? I can't escape the memory of Jews on crowded cattle cars, shipped off like animals in an attempt to rob them of their dignity, of their humanity. And then the guilt sets in. How dare I ride in luxury, sipping bottled water on the very same tracks where Jews were shipped like animals and sent to death camps, hungry, thirsty, tired, suffocating, unsure of their future, uncertain of their fate. Why even go to this country whose very earth is soaked in Jewish blood? And I felt the same way, admittedly, when I visited Germany for the first time, some 15 years ago, crisscrossing the country on trains to visit cities and small Jewish communities, teaching and speaking. I was torn, conflicted. I felt guilty. Even my father-in-law, who's a mild-mannered tzaddik, very quiet, doesn't really impose his views on others, but I remember how he even expressed his reservations about me traveling to Germany for the first time after what they did to his father. I can only justify or rationalize or reconcile it with the fact that when I visit Poland, it's to teach Torah to members of the Polish Jewish community
and maybe, hopefully, I have something which I can contribute. Maybe I can help them deepen their commitment to Torah and mitzvot, help them deepen their commitment to the land of Israel. And for that, it's worth taking a train from one end of the world to the other. So here are some pictures of Torah being taught and learned in Poland today. Torah machzeret al achsanya shela. As Chazal tell us, the Torah returns to its place. It was wonderful, wonderful people there in the Jewish community. Here I am teaching Torah and singing with little children. Tinokot shel Beit Rabban. And so the question that I'll end with is there a greater victory over Hitler and the Nazis than teaching Torah in Poland? Here, by the way, in the middle of the circle is just one of the great shlichim, one of the great rabbis from Israel that's leading Polish Jewry today, a good friend of mine. We'll end with a video featuring some of the beautiful synagogues of Krakow. I mentioned how Krakow was all of these beautiful synagogues. Most prominently, the Ramah Shul, where I had the tremendous zchut to daven a number of times. In 1989, Shlomo Kalbach made a historic visit to Poland for a series of performances. But after visiting Auschwitz and Majdanek and the ghettos, death and destruction, and Shlomo found himself here in the Ramah Shul in Krakow, tired and depressed. He shed some tears and began to doze off. And in his dream, Shlomo saw Jews marching. And he believes they're marching to the gas chambers, marching to their deaths. He sees them boarding trains, and he believes they're being trained in camps. He sees them walking into a chamber and believes it to be the gas chamber. But when the door opens, it's not a gas chamber at all. Instead, he sees millions of Jews dressed in white, smiling. And Shlomo asks them, "Where are you going?" And they tell him, "We're going to Yerushalayim." So Shlomo awoke and immediately composed this nigun, the Krakow. This is us singing the Krakow nigun today in Krakow. Now the haunting melody of the Krakow nigun goes from slow and mournful, melancholic to upbeat and celebratory, representing both the tragedy and the triumph that is Jewish history. The tragedy and the triumph that is Jewish history. In fact, as the students report, the Shlomo would become incensed. He would be upset and get angry when people would just sing this portion of the book, this upbeat part of the book. As he believed that you have to experience the sorrow before you can truly appreciate the sin. The taste of pain before you can taste the sin. As I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, there was initially so much discussion and debate as to the creation of Yom HaShoah. But it wasn't only in the Knesset. Contemporary poskim, Rabbanim, debated if it is appropriate to add new days of mourning to the Jewish calendar, or if the Shoah should be commemorated on the day in which we commemorate all national calamities and tragedies throughout Jewish history, Tisha B'Av. Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sri De'esh, himself a survivor, provides a compelling argument for the observance of such a day in a preface to one of his tshuvot. And he writes the following, and we'll end with this. Lidati ra'ui likbo ayom evel v'zikaron miyuchad lezecher rabanei u'kdoshei Yisrael shenehergu v'shenitapchu v'shenisrefu al kidush Hashem u'lahazkir b'yom ze et nishmotehem shel kidoshim eile. In my opinion, it is proper to establish a special day of mourning and remembrance to remember the rabbis and holy Jews who were murdered, butchered, and burned in the sanctification of God's holy name, and to remember on this day the souls of these martyrs. Tzrichim anachnu lasot ken lo mishum kvodam shel hakdoshim bilvad, ela gam bishvil hadorot habaim shelo yishkechu ma avad la'amenu bizman shechoshech harishut haratzchanit kisat artzot Europa. We must do so not just because of the honor due these martyrs alone, because of future generations, that they not forget what our people lost when the evil, murderous darkness covered over Europe. I wish you all a meaningful Yom HaShoah. I'd be happy to take now any questions.
I just want to, on behalf of everyone, thank Rav Shimshon for a very powerful presentation. Rav Shimshon said he is available to take a few questions now. And Yehi Zichron Baruch. May all the...
Hello, Shimshon. I visited the ghetto in both Warsaw and Krakow. And of course, in Krakow, you really see the ghetto, and they still have the walls, and they still have most of the buildings. What did you think of the museum in Warsaw? It was very impressive and very expensive, but don't you think it would have been better if it would have been built in Israel rather than there?
Of course, you know, that's always the tension. But look, you know, it's not only for the Jews who are still there. It's really for everyone to come and learn about 1,000 years of Jewish history in Poland. You know, that's the mission statement of the museum.
It was a fabulous museum. It was a fabulous museum.
Okay, thank you for your comment. Any other questions? Okay, so again, I wish you all a meeting.
Stupid question. Did you wear a kippah or a hat?
Depends on where I was. Both. Okay.
What language did the Sri Deish write his Shuvot or his Divrei Torah in?
His Shuvot are written Hebrew. His Shuvot are written in Hebrew. He also, he wrote in German, but in Polish, I'm sure. But you know, he was a big scholar of both Torah and Mada, big academic scholar as well. Okay, thank you again. We should all have a meaningful Yom HaShoah, and Yehi Zichron Baruch. The memory of all of these kedoshim should be for a blessing. Mm-hmm.